there's an ad on television which asks, what happens when you die? Will you go to heaven or not? Now, occasionally someone will ask me the question, what happens when I die? And the individual is not usually asking about my afterlife, but about the future of the church. Some people think that I'll be around until Christ returns. That's optimistic. Perhaps indicates a soon return of Christ, which I think that we would all agree that the way the world is going, that Christ will have to come back before we destroy ourselves. But considering that a lot of people live well into their 80s and 90s, it's certainly a possibility. But none of us know how long we're going to be here. We don't know how long we have until Christ returns. We don't know whether we're going to live to see tomorrow. None of us, no matter what our age might be. When I was younger, I was involved with sports quite a bit. Played football, baseball, did some swimming, and ran some track. Track and field was probably my later sport in life. I didn't get involved until my senior year of high school. Bob and I used to run at lunchtime just for the exercise. We'd run a couple miles, and we'd shower, eat an apple and an orange, and go to class. And because we were doing that, they had a turkey trot. It's a run for a turkey at Thanksgiving time, and I participated in that. And to the surprise of probably most of us, I actually won it. And didn't know that I was going to win until the very last. I kind of psyched myself out when I saw who was running. But the coach then signed me up for track, and I ran my senior year only a couple times, two, three, four times, because most of them were on the Sabbath, and by that time I was keeping the Sabbath. I ran a little bit in Ventura College, not competitively, simply because I had transferred from one college to a different one and was not eligible that year. But then at Ambassador College, we had one day a year where we ran track and field. And it was always a big day, but we were only, might say, weekend warriors when it came to track and field. We didn't run that much, but we did to keep in shape. And that was mostly the reason that I ran track. A lot of lessons you can learn from field sports such as that. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that today. Today's sermon, I'm going to address passing the baton. I'm going to show you that the church will endure until the end. Whether I'm here or not, it doesn't depend on me or any other individual. We know who the head of the church is, and that's Jesus Christ. And we know what he said. For example, in Matthew, the 16th chapter, we read a very famous passage of Scripture. You probably know exactly what it is. But in Matthew 16 and in verse 18, let me start in verse 17. Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter. In other words, you are a small rock. And on this rock, a very different word, meaning a large, massive rock, meaning himself, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades or the grave shall not prevail against it. So he's saying here that the gates of the grave would not prevail against his church. His church would continue. And so 2,000 years of history, as well as the Bible itself, shows that the true church of God will endure all the way to the end. We also have Revelation, the second and third chapters. I'm not going to take time to go through them today. But we know that there are seven church congregations that were in existence in Asia Minor, as we would call it today. And we knew that there are many more churches, but these were on a mail route. And when we read those descriptions of those churches, we understand for a multitude of reasons that they picture the true church of God down through the centuries. And while scholars try to connect them up because they recognize there's a little bit more to them than simply seven churches at that time, they are unable to do so because they're looking at the wrong place. They're looking at the mainstream Christian congregations or church, and it simply does not fit. But when you understand that this is talking about the small church that Christ started, not the major apostate church, but the true church, then we see how it is talking about seven different stages that the church would go through. And we know that in Revelation, the third chapter, the Sardis era, which was almost dead or dying, we certainly do believe that that's the church, the era that Mr. Herbert Armstrong came in contact with. And that era had a name that was alive, but it was dying, called the Church of God Seventh Day. And Mr. Armstrong came along and the church revived in a big way for quite a few years. But then at Mr. Armstrong's death, a lot of things have happened since that time. I'd like to read Revelation, the 12th chapter, part of it, because this shows that there is a church all the way to the end of the age. And it really begins with the history of the church in the wilderness, you might say, with Israel, physical Israel, and how the Christ would be born from that, and how the devil would try to destroy him, and how the true church then would have to go into the wilderness for 1260 years. We have an article on the subject, not an article, but a booklet on the subject, God's Church Through the Ages. And I hope that all of you will take time to review that if you haven't for some time, or if you've never read it, please do read it. I know as a field minister, I learned to a great deal of depth that people tend to be collectors more than readers. That people order literature, they order these booklets, and then they sit on a coffee table looking nice, but aren't always read. And I think the same is true within the church itself, that sometimes people have them. Well, I know that, and I don't need it. But brethren, please do take the time to review these booklets that have been written and that do give important information. So God's Church Through the Ages goes through the seven stages of the church, as it's listed there in Revelation 2 and 3. But we also see that the church would be in the wilderness for 1260 years. And then we come down to let's start in verse 9, where it says, "So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." So this is after the 1260 years. This is coming down to our time. And we do not believe he's been cast out yet, but I'm not sure that we'll know exactly the day that he's cast out. We see that the world is going in a very bad direction in the last few years, but we'll probably recognize something even more dramatic. He's cast out of heaven. He was deceives the whole world. He's cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, "Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down." So that would probably indicate that when he's cast down, he's going to carry on accusation, not up in heaven, but he's going to carry on accusation upon this earth, the time of persecution of the true church. Verse 11, "They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death," showing that there is coming a time of future persecution, even to the point of death. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. The time of Satan's wrath is the 2.5-year period of that we call the tribulation. The day of the Lord is a year after that, a total of 3.5 years. He says, now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, what did he do? He persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. In other words, the church. But the woman was given 2 wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she's nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So we see that there is this woman. There is the church all the way to the very end, down to the last 3.5 years before Christ returned. And the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. This is not talking about a rapture going off to heaven. This is talking about the true church fleeing from persecution to someplace on this earth, a place of safety as we often refer to it. And so he's going to spew out water, perhaps an army chasing after the woman. We don't know exactly for sure whether it's a literal army or a literal water or an army. But he's going to spew that out after the woman to destroy her. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Something very similar to the crossing of the Red Sea. A little different, but something similar. And what happens? The dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. We see from that statement alone. This is not talking about physical Israel at this point. It's talking about spiritual Israel, those who have not only the commandments of God, but the testimony of Jesus Christ. And so we understand that to be that the Philadelphia era of the church, primarily, goes to a place of safety. I say primarily because very likely there will be some in the Philadelphia era early on that are persecuted, perhaps martyred. But the majority of the Philadelphia era, as we read the promise there in Revelation, the 3rd chapter, talks about he will spare them from the time of trouble that's going to come upon the earth. But we also know that he's going to then cast the Laodicean era into great tribulation because they are self-satisfied and they are lukewarm and they're not doing what God expects them to do, and yet they are commandment keepers and they have the testimony of Jesus Christ, and because Christ loves them, he's going to bring punishment upon them to force them to make a decision one way or the other. Now, we're not here to condemn others. I think, believe that we are the remnant of Philadelphia, but that certainly does not mean that every single one of us in this room are Philadelphian in spirit or in the church, the living church of God as a whole. There are no doubt those who are of a Laodicean spirit, and some are of an Ephesian spirit where they've lost their first love. There are all kinds of different attitudes that can exist at any given time within the church. But this is what we understand. So we see that the church will continue all the way down to the end. You don't have to worry about that. It will continue all the way down to the end. The Bible and 2,000 years of history testify that the true church will endure to the very end. I was going to go into a little bit of the history of what has happened here in the past, but my wife was listening to a sermon today that I'd given about a year ago, a little bit over a year ago, titled Remember, Don't Forget. And I realized that I covered much of that material at that time. So, not to be tedious, we do know that God raised up a very unusual individual in Mr. Herbert Armstrong for a very important purpose, and we believe that was to raise up the Philadelphia era of the church. And God brought him to the fore right at the time when The world was changing electronically. Radio was in its infancy. And God humbled Mr. Herbert Armstrong through his wife concerning the Sabbath. He just assumed that Sunday was a day that we are to rest. And when his wife was convinced that no, it's Saturday, he tried to convince her otherwise. And in the process, he found out that he was wrong. And as he said one time when I was there in his presence, he says, it's a very humbling thing to lose an argument to your wife, especially when it's the most important one you've ever had. But he lost that argument. And he began to associate with the people of the Church of God Seventh Day up there in Oregon. And then an opportunity came to a minister. He had been ordained by that time. And an opportunity in 1934, January, I believe it was the 7th, to go on a radio station at 6 o'clock in the morning. It was a 100-watt radio station. Now, we have 50,000-watt stations coming out of Mexico and elsewhere, and much larger stations, but this was the smallest station you might have, and no other minister in the area was willing to go on the radio, so he did. And people began responding to it and calling in or writing to him, and a work was begun. Even within the Church of God Seventh Day, nevertheless, he was cooperating with them, and the work began. He and his wife began keeping the Feast of Tabernacles and the other holy days on their own because the Church of God Seventh Day did not. But he read them, and he realized that if the Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath, is still in effect, so are these days, and he saw that Christ kept them, and the apostles kept these days, and so they began keeping the feasts on their own. In 1947, he started Ambassador College with four students. I have a picture on my desk that Mr. Stephen Elliott had passed on to me of Ambassador College in 1950, several years later. And they had 20 students at that time. Our living education program has 22. So we think it's small, but even after its existence for several years, from 47 to 50, they only had 20 students. They start out with four. Now it was a four-year college, a lot different from what we have at Living Education. But we see the desire to train younger people to understand the doctrines of the church, to have a little bit more formal education, to teach them a way of life in a very special way. And that's very important. The church began to grow after Ambassador College was started, very slowly at first, but it grew, and we went from one festival site to two to three festival sites here in the United States as well as elsewhere in the world. And in 1968, while I was at Ambassador College, I remember they came in one evening and said they were changing the name from the Radio Church of God, because that's how Mr. Armstrong started out on radio, to the Worldwide Church of God, because the church at that time was far more worldwide and radio was not really a proper description of it. The 1970s were a difficult time for the church. We had a number of scandals, problems. We had individuals who were trying to take the church in a different direction. The Systematic Theology Project, as we called it, the STP, was handed out to all the ministry, and Mr. Armstrong recalled that because it began to change, in some ways, very slowly, certain doctrines. And at the end of the 70s, Mr. Armstrong had a heart attack, nearly died, but God revived him. We also had an attempted takeover, actually it was more than an attempted takeover of the church by the state of California. And I know that I mentioned that one time in a Bible study back in Kansas City, probably 10, 12 years after the fact, and all the young people had funny looks on their face. They didn't know that the state of California tried to take over the church. They eventually failed. Case was cast out of court. the state was overstepping its bounds. And of course, the accusations were false anyway. But nevertheless, we won that case. I remember where I was when I heard about it. I had just come home after being semi-stranded in a blizzard, living up in Michigan, and I was nursing my wounds after six cars that had to be pushed out to get to a place where we could move on, and nearly frostbite on my toes and my hands. So I was looking for a little sympathy when I got home, and my wife had heard about this takeover, and she's telling me about that, and I'm talking about my troubles, and we were carrying on two monologues, each looking for sympathy. But nevertheless, that happened, late 70s. And then God revived Mr. Armstrong and gave him seven more years, from 79 to 86, to get the church back on track, which he began to do because it had gotten off track. Now, when you look at church history, you find that church has gone off track all the time. You read the book of Galatians, and you see that Paul was concerned about them getting off track. And just read through the New Testament, you find that. There is a spirit being out there who is trying to destroy the church of God. He will always fail, but it can always have an effect on a certain number of people. Now, this last Tuesday was the 38th anniversary of the death of Mr. Herbert Armstrong. And I'm always amused a little bit about, well, not amused, but chagrined by the fact that there are those who came out of an apostasy that took place after that and say that, well, the work was all done because it was done by Mr. Armstrong, and there's nothing to do except just get the bride ready and wait for Christ's return. I think even here today we have one or two or three new people. And the work is not finished. It continues going on. In 38 years, when you think about it, anybody under the age of about 50 would probably know very little about Mr. Armstrong or what he did. And even there, the whole world didn't know the truth that it needs to know. Not that it'll go along with it, but at least having a warning. Now, following Mr. Armstrong's death, there was a video that was published, Behind the Work video, Passing the Baton. And it was a very well done video, and the intent was certainly good, that when one leader dies, the baton is passed to someone else. It's a reference to a relay race, and you have different relay races. One of them that I participated in, I always loved the 4x400 or 4x440, as it was called then, 440 yards, which is about 7.5 yards further than a 400. But in a 440 or four times running that, runners, that's usually the last race of the meet, you have a little bit of time to, that you can flub a little bit in passing the baton. You have a little bit of, because your speeds are slower, if you have a bad pass, if it's not too bad, you can still catch up and you can still win the race. But in a 4x100 relay, which is essentially a sprint by four individuals, the passing of the baton is very important. And those who have never run a race may not realize it, but you have about 20 meters or just a little bit less than 22 yards in which to pass that baton. And so the one who is to receive the baton cannot start before a line that is there, and the baton has to be passed to him before he crosses the next line that is up there about 20 to 22 yards away. And so the runner must start running for a short race like 4x100, he needs to start at the exact right time so that his speed is up to speed of the one coming toward him, and grab that baton and run before he crosses that line. And any misstep is enough to usually put that team out of the race. It has to be very smooth. And sadly, when the baton was passed from Mr. Armstrong to the next individual, the individual dropped the baton and took the church in a very bad direction. What followed his death was that the church began to change ever so slightly within a year or two. His successor began quietly changing some doctrines. I remember one of the things that really upset me at the beginning when I started seeing some of these changes. One of them was that we began to use a lot of religious art in our telecasts. Now, Mr. Ames could probably tell you a lot more about what happened with the telecast and what they were wanting. They were wanting changes in the telecast because he was one of the presenters at that time. But also, they started downplaying healing, as we heard a little bit about in the sermonette about going to God about things, and oftentimes it is about healing. And they began downplaying the effect of the stripes of Christ. And so in John, the sixth chapter, John 6, this was used to say that we are not healed by the stripes of Christ, that that's just metaphorical. In John, the sixth chapter, beginning in verse 51, Jesus said, "I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I give is my flesh, which I give for the life of the world." And the Jews therefore quarreled among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" And Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you." Now, all of that is absolutely correct and true. Obviously so. We believe that. And it really comes down to the Passover service, which we read of later on in Scripture, that we eat his flesh, symbolized there by the unleavened bread, and drink his blood, symbolized by the wine, the small amount of wine that we have there. The wine symbolizes blood, the bread symbolizes his flesh. But when you read this here, it shows that we must eat the flesh and drink the blood. Again, symbolically, we don't literally eat. We're not cannibals, okay? There are those who believe that. But we see there that both are required for eternal life. But when we go back to Isaiah, the 53rd chapter, there's something stated here that was being downplayed or just neglected altogether. Isaiah 53. This is a prophecy of the Messiah. Beginning in verse 1, "Who has believed our report, and to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as root out of dry ground. He has no form or comeliness, and we see him. There's no beauty that we should desire him." This is clearly a prophecy of Christ. It actually begins in the chapter before, the 52nd chapter, where in verse 14 it says, "As many were astonished at you, so his visage was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men, so shall he sprinkle many nations," and so forth. But then verse 3 of chapter 53, "He's despised and rejected by man, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised and we did not esteem him. Surely he has borne our griefs." Now, if you have a marginal reference there, it says literally, "our sicknesses." He has borne our sicknesses and carried our sorrows or our pains. "Yet we esteemed or reckoned him stricken," smitten or struck down by God, "and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions. And it goes on from there, he bruised for our iniquities. Now clearly it says that we are, he has carried our sicknesses. And when we go over to 1 Peter, the second chapter, 1 Peter 2, we read a very clear statement. And verse 24, but I'll start a little bit earlier. 1 Peter 2, let's go with verse 21. It says, for to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who when he was reviled did not revile in return, when he suffered he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. In other words, we are healed by the stripes of Christ, to the beating that he received, the bruising. All of that was to pay a penalty for our physical healing. But it was a type of the spiritual healing, because we have a spiritual sickness as well as human beings. And so one is a type of the other. It's not either or, it's both. That the healing is both physical and spiritual. He paid the penalty because many of our afflictions are the result of sin. Not all, but many of them are. And it is by his stripes that we are healed. We're very thankful for that. But that was being downplayed. It was just being spiritualized away as though it didn't matter. Now one could see how they could perhaps do that. And for those of us who went through that, you tried to understand, you tried to look at the fault as being your own, that maybe I'm just unwilling to change or unwilling to accept something. And yet it was very difficult to get past some of these things. There were other changes, such as wearing a cross is okay. It just identifies you as a Christian. You don't worship that cross, although people kiss it. People look at it differently. And, of course, that declined the fact that the cross was used as a religious symbol long before Christ came along. We see the Anka cross in Egyptian, not literature, but pictures, where they have that kind of a loop in a cross. And the cross has been used in many different ways long before Christ came along. And as we've so often said, if Christ had been shot, would we hang a gun around our neck? Or if he had been hung by the neck, would we have a hangman's noose hanging around our neck? So why do people hang a cross around their neck? Well, or have it on their wall or whatever. And when you look into the history of it, it was a religious symbol long before Christ came along. But that was another thing that, well, it doesn't really matter. It's just a physical thing, and it just identifies you as a Christian. Another change was that the Passover and night to be observed were the same night historically. In other words, the Old Testament tells us that the Passover is the 14th, the feast is the 15th, and that has always been somewhat controversial, and yet it's really not hard to discern, and I'm not going to give a whole sermon on that subject right now. But it was a change by saying that, well, the Old Testament Passover at the time of Moses, that was the same night as the night to be observed. But that was explained away as saying that, well, it's just a historical issue. It doesn't change what we do, because we still keep the Passover at the beginning of the 14th. Then there was the God Is booklet. Sometimes we say God is dot, dot, dot. The ellipsis. It introduced the concept of the Trinity, but in different language. And in all these cases, the changes or the reason for them was always denied. No, we're not teaching the Trinity, but they were. They were teaching the Trinity, but they denied it. Now we have a booklet, John 3:16, that the very first chapter shows a little bit of the history of the Trinity, where it comes from, and why it is not a correct doctrine. We believe in God the Father. We believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. We also believe that the Holy Spirit that flows out from the power that flows out from them and the mind of Christ that can be put in us, or the mind of God through the Spirit, but not as a person. But of course, they changed the idea of a person. It's not three persons, it's three hypostases. And just as in what we see today, a change of language, there was a change of language in the church at that time. And if we had said there were three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that would have raised flags. I say we, if they had said that, not me. But instead, they said there were three hypostases, using a Greek term there. And that kind of put it on a different level. But they were still teaching it. What amazed me, and this is a lesson for all of us, what amazed me is how few people came up with questions. I was pastoring a church there of, I don't know, 350, 400. It was morning and afternoon, but about 400 people, maybe a little bit more. Don't remember the exact number. But it was, I guess it was over 400. But it amazed me that so few people had any questions. How could they read that booklet and not have questions? And I concluded they're simply not reading. They're not reading literature. So when the doctrines began to change, they didn't know because they weren't reading what was being said. The Passover was changed to the Lord's Supper, a more traditional statement. Well, when you say the Lord's Supper, I guess you can call it that, even though Paul said it is not to eat the Lord's Supper, but if you want to call it that. But what it did is it diminished the fact that what Jesus ate with his disciples was the Passover. And when people do not keep the holy days, or in this case, it was not a holy day, the Passover, but the next day, they don't understand all kinds of things like the sequence of events at the crucifixion, the 3 days and the three nights. But they change it from Passover to Lord's Supper, even calling it, in some cases, Eucharist. Now, once they had done that, then it's just the Lord's Supper. We don't have to keep it just once a year at the time of Passover, but eventually they moved it to keeping it, you know, once a month or whenever it was. I don't know. I was gone by then, but they began keeping it at different times. Now, since they keep it the way that the world does, it's a short ceremony within a service, and they stopped reading what we used to read during the Passover service. As an example, John, the 13th chapter, 13th through the 17th chapters, and you can begin to understand why they did not want to read those chapters. And let me just give you a couple examples of why they would not want to read those chapters. The Trinity says that the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit are all equals. Yet Jesus says in chapter 14 and verse 28, I am going to the Father, the last part of it, for my Father is greater than I. And of course, the next verse, or two verses later, the 30th chapter, I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming, and he has nothing in me. The concept, this is not God's world right now. We know that God has authority over everything, but he left Satan down here as the ruler of this world. And three times in the book of John, it speaks of the ruler of this world. And it's not talking about God, it's talking about the devil. In the 16th chapter, or 15th chapter, let me read there, chapter 15, verse 18, and I'm skipping over many things here, but he says, if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. Yet because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. And yet the leader who took over after Mr. Armstrong's death one time said, I don't like to be thought of as a cult. Now, sometimes people ask, are you a cult? Well, how do you answer that? It depends on what you mean by a cult, I suppose. The real question is, are you teaching what Christ taught, or are you teaching something else? Because it's so easy to show that mainstream Christianity is teaching doctrines that come out of rank paganism and heathenism. That is so easy to show. So it's not a matter, are you a cult or not? Are you right? But he would rather have been wrong than to be thought of in a negative light in the eyes of this world's religions. He says over here in the 17th chapter, in the prayer that Jesus gave at the right before he was taken into custody, he's in verse 14, he says, I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. The world hates what we are teaching. I just got a note from Mr. Tyler down in Australia that one of my sermons had been flagged by YouTube, because I guess I talked about, the best we can understand, we're not even sure, about local eating customs. It's probably where I talked about the fact that people eat bats and then they wonder why we have Ebola or MERS or Nipah virus. Or SARS-1, which was the reason they were studying bats, which probably gave us COVID. So if you tell the truth, it's misinformation. That's what they called it, misinformation. The world hates the truth. And that's pretty mild compared to speaking out against LGBTQ, whatever. Mr. Smith has thrown off a station in British Columbia, when he talked about the war against normal, and just quoting, sources on that subject. Anything that's normal, the world hates, or at least the people that are in charge of the world, they hate it. And we know who's really behind it all. It goes on, verse 16, they are not of the world just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. Then in verse 20, this was certainly something they did not want read, because it really flies in the face of Trinitarian doctrine. He says, I do not pray that these alone, for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word, that they all may be one, as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be one in us. Now, the Trinity is closed off. No one else can enter into that God relationship. Our booklet on the subject of your ultimate destiny, or we change it to, whatever it is, you can find it, on the purpose of life. that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me. And then verse 22, and the glory which you gave me, I have given them, that they may be one just as we are one. Two separate beings, the Father and the Son, and yet they're one, not in some sort of a amalgamation of bodies, but in mind and spirit and in purpose and intent. And he's praying that we may be one with them just as they are one. So it defines the oneness of God. But they would rather use the oneness as it was presented by heathen philosophers, Greek philosophy, that concept of oneness. People like Origen and others who were heavily influenced by heathen philosophy. You know, they loved words like hermeneutics. You probably haven't heard hermeneutics in a long time. If I ask for a show of hands, how many understand what hermeneutics is? Probably not a whole lot of hands, but I might be surprised. We'd go up. It has to do with how we study and how we study the scriptures. We talk about seven keys to understanding the Bible, but they wanted to use a more highfalutin term. Well, you know, as it says over in 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, and this became very clear, that there's a certain vanity because some of these men went off to seminaries to get higher degrees, and they came back different from when they went there. I always like Jerry Clower when he talks about this fellow that went off to Baylor University, a Baptist school, and he said when he came back, he didn't talk like himself no more. He had to have a different way of talking about things. But here in chapter 8 of 1 Corinthians, verse 1, it says, now concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. Knowledge puffs up. And so if you can use words that are strange to the audience, like hermeneutics or hypostases or other religious terms that they throw in there, that makes you higher up, and everybody else, I guess, should then look up to you as, well, you're knowledgeable and I'm not. In 1 Corinthians, the 3rd chapter, shows us what God thinks of all this wisdom of the world. In verse 19, 1 Corinthians 3:19, for the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. For it is written, he catches the wise in their own craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they're futile. Therefore, let no one boast in men, for all things are yours. And he goes on from there. So there was a great emphasis on that. But with every change, it was always, oh, we're not changing anything. Doesn't that remind you what you hear in the news? Oh, the border is closed. We don't have an open border. It's under control. And how many other things like that we hear in our world today? It says it does one thing, and the language is different. What is stated is different. The laws of clean and unclean meats were dismissed. And then on December the 17th, one of the field ministers got ahead of things, and he gave a sermon that the leader of the church at that time in Pasadena felt he had to come out and straighten out. So actually it was the week before, but he came out on the 17th, and that was really the shot heard around the world. And then he went to Big Sandy, Texas, the 24th of December, 1994, and he gave a sermon where he threw everything that we'd always believed under the old covenant. Now, he didn't spell it all out yet, but he was going that direction. And he said that to work on the Sabbath to support your family was okay. And he gave the example of how the church had to support somebody with $40,000 the year before because he lost his job over the Sabbath. Well, as a field minister, I can tell you that would never have happened from the field ministry. It would have had to have special permission from headquarters. We were allowed to give assistance. We actually had checkbooks. We could give assistance, I think $600 within a month and $1,000 within 2 months or something like that. I don't remember the exact time length, but it was a very short period of time there. But like so many things, the truth was always a casualty. Substituting world holidays for Sabbaths and holy days came along, of course, and ultimately what happened is that organization that was making those changes is a fraction of what it once was, but it's a Protestant church today and fairly liberal one at that. Now, why is all this important? I know that I talked a little bit about this in that other sermon on Remember, Don't Forget, but why is this important? Well, it's important that we know history, because history has lessons for us, whether it be in our nation or whether it be in the church. Have you ever noticed how many times in Scripture a servant would go back and rehearse the history of what happened before? For example, in Deuteronomy, the first chapter, the whole book of Deuteronomy is really rehearsing what had gone before. But it begins in Deuteronomy 1 and verse 1. Deuteronomy 1 verse 1, it says, "These are the words which Moses spoke to all Israel on this side of the Jordan in the wilderness and the plain opposite, Suf, whatever how you pronounce it." Verse 2, "It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea." In other words, it was an 11 days' journey for them. But the next verse says, "It came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to all that the Lord had commanded him as commandments to them." And then it begins to go through some of the history of the nation. You can read it there. In other words, it took 40 years to go 11 days' journey. And he shows why. Because of their rebellions. And he shows that over and over. Notice over in Psalm 78. We find this, I'm just giving three examples here. I'll give you three. But there are many others. Where the servant of God always went back to the beginning, just like Mr. Herbert Armstrong used to go back to the beginning of Genesis. How do we get here? Well, we start out with Adam and Eve and their rejection of God through choosing the wrong tree. But here in Psalm 78, verse 1, "Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us." Our fathers have told us. You know, what really is behind what I'm saying here is that we have constantly new generations that come along. And it really doesn't matter whether you came to the church on your own or whether you grew up in the church. There are differences. When you come in on your own, You've proven some things for yourself. At least you should have. But when Worldwide broke up, we have people that came in on their own as well as people who grew up in the church who didn't stay with it. So it doesn't make one better than the other. But it's so easy growing up in the church to take things for granted. I know that the church of God will continue all the way to the end. I've just read a few scriptures on that earlier. The question is, will you, as an individual, stay there all the way to the end? Because you have to do something if you hope to be there. I remember a sermon at the Feast of Tabernacles up in Squaw Valley. My first Feast of Tabernacles would have been 1964. It might have been 65. Could have been 3 years after that. But it was, I think, the first year or two. And one of the ministers gave this dream that he had about the resurrection taking place, and everybody was going up in the air, and he wasn't. And he started waving his arms like a bird trying to get off the ground, and he couldn't. And he was talking about whether someone would be left behind. We often had sermons at the end of the feast, will you be here next year? And always there would be those who would not be. When I look at young people today, I just yearn for them to stay with the truth. I hope that they will prove it for themselves. They must prove it for themselves. They can't get on into the kingdom on the coattails of mom and dad. They have to prove it. But this applies to all of us. Here in chapter 78, he says, for he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children. We have to make these things known to our children, but our children have to be receptive of them. That the generation to come might know, or might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children. In other words, a third generation, another one. That they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. And may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and a rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright, and whose spirit was not faithful to God. And then it starts talking about the history of Israel, coming out of Egypt and so forth. We have to pass this history on to our children, but they have to be willing to accept it and not be stiff-necked like their fathers. You can read Acts, the 7th chapter. I won't take the time for that, but that's Stephen's defense before he was martyred. And what did he do? He went back to the beginning and he told the history to those stubborn Israelites of here's what's happened down through history, and you've always been stubborn and rebellious, just like our fathers. And they couldn't stand that. They killed him. There are other examples where the Bible goes back in time to show the history so that people understand where we came from and what happened before, and watch out for the dangers that are ahead. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that the church is going to go into apostasy again the way that it did. Please don't misunderstand that. In fact, I want to talk about that a little bit here before I finish, but I need to move on. It's important to understand these things. We had an individual, a young minister, a few years ago, who was running around telling people that Mr. Weston is going to take the church in the direction of Tekoch, which I found rather humorous. Since when did he get in my head to know what I'm thinking? And what made it even more humorous was he wasn't even a teenager when all those things happened. So what made him an expert on that? Well, it was at the beginning of the pandemic, and we didn't know exactly how things were going to turn out there. There was a lot of uncertainty as to how this pandemic is going to play out. And so the church made decisions. Such decisions as if the government says no more than 10, we would keep that. If they say we had to wear a mask, we'll do that. There were other things that were on a personal nature, but when it came to collectively, we followed along with some of those things. You know, the changes in the worldwide Church of God were not administrative decisions made at the beginning of a pandemic, something that we had never faced before as a church in any kind of modern times. When we really didn't know what we're dealing with, they were doctrinal. Changes of the worldwide were doctrinal. They were major. They were intentional. And they were sold deceptively, saying one thing and meaning something else. And those changes led to the breakup of worldwide and Dr. Meredith in 93, I believe it is, or at the end of 92, began what was called the Radio Church of God, and then not radio, but the Global Church of God, and then it was later changed to Living Church of God when there were some individuals who tried to overthrow, and they basically self-destructed. You know, Dr. Meredith did not expect that when he died that we would repeat what happened with the worldwide church. And neither do I. Neither do I. I do believe that there will always be individuals who go off on their own and try to take others with them. But a major disruption such as happened worldwide, I don't think will happen again for three reasons. I don't think there's enough time, first of all. I think world conditions indicate that time is short. But perhaps more importantly, we have faithful, tested men who are of a very different character than the ones who took the church in the wrong direction after Mr. Armstrong's death. The men that we have on our council today are men who faced that apostasy and didn't go along with it and stood up and lost jobs in some cases and had difficulties, but they stood up against the crowd and they said, no, we're not going to go that way. I love the truth. I'm going to stay with the truth. And I know that there are men on the council, younger men, who are faithful men, who are very bright individuals on top of it. Frankly, a lot smarter than me. They may not have had the same experiences, same degree of experiences, partly because they're not old enough to have all the things that, you know, when you get older, you just have more time to do things. But then there's evidence from the Bible. In Matthew 24:14, it says, this gospel will be preached in all the world for a witness unto all the nations. And then the end will come. So there has to be a church that's going to preach the truth all the way to the end. You don't have to worry about it not being there. We already saw in Revelation 12 that there are a couple groups at the end. Some that go to a place of safety, some that go through the tribulation. You compare that with Revelation 3 as well, where you can read in our booklets on the subject. So the church will endure. The only question is, will you? That's really the only question. The church endured the disruption of what happened in worldwide. The church is still here. But sadly, a lot of people that were once with us are not. And it comes down to an individual relationship with God and what one is willing to do. Is time so short that the old timers are going to limp across the finish line with no one to pass it to? You know, the passing of the baton takes place all the time. It isn't just here and here. But it's gradual. We gradually pass it on to a younger generation. It takes place all the time. But if the younger generation has to have the baton passed to it, then it means that there is a generation worthy of their calling. Because the church will continue. So if I die, or you know, Mr. Ames or Mr. Smith or Mr. McNair or some of the rest of us, the church is going to go on. It's nothing to be feared. The only thing to fear is, what am I doing personally as an individual? Am I close to God? Because there are a lot of people that were sitting high in the saddle when the changes came and they found themselves sitting on the ground wondering what happened. In Joshua, the 24th chapter, Joshua 24, right at the end of the life of Joshua, he says here in verse 14, Now therefore, fear the Eternal, serve him in sincerity and truth. He had brought the people together. And put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt, serve the Eternal. Now we can sit back and say, well, we don't have foreign gods. Well, read Mr. Smith's article, or was it the telecast on old gods, new gods? Something like that, new gods. Yeah, just look up Mr. Smith. He'll tell you. The gods of the mind. It's interesting, Nebuchadnezzar, when you read Daniel's account there of Nebuchadnezzar, he wanted them to bow down before an image. And I'm sorry, it wasn't the image. It was when they were saying, what God can, only the gods can reveal the dream. Now, they worshipped images, but they saw those images as representations of gods, just like Catholicism and various other religions. They say, we're not worshipping that image. That's just reminding us of God. It's the same thing back there, and you can actually show that even the heathen do that by reading the book of Daniel. You'll find it there. But we have all kinds of gods today. Read that article, look at that telecast, the sermon, whichever it was, by Mr. Smith on new gods or old gods. And it shows that we have plenty of new gods, gods of the mind, idols of the mind, idols of the heart. Mr. McNair gave a sermon on that, idols of the heart or idols of the mind. In verse 15 it says, if it seems evil to you to serve the Eternal, choose yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river or the gods of the Amorites in the land in which you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Eternal. Now, the gods that were way back in Egypt or the gods of the new land, they're all around. And that has not changed. We have gods of climate change. We have gods of, wokeness and DEI and the worship of all those things. All kinds of gods. We have politicians that, frankly, are looked upon as gods. There's only one God. Sometimes people worship the God of the Second Amendment. You know, they want their guns. That becomes their God. In verse 17, he says, for the Lord our God is he who brought us up, our fathers up out of the land of Egypt, who did great signs and wonders, etc., etc. And then we'll go over to Judges, the second chapter, and verse 7. So the people served the Eternal all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Eternal, which he had done for Israel. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Eternal, died when he was 110 years of age, and they buried him within the border of inheritance. Verse 10, when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Eternal, nor the work which he had done for Israel. And you see that they went in a very bad direction. I hope that our newer generation will know the works of God, will prove these things for themselves. I know this, though, that whether I live or whether I die, the Church of God will go on. The only question is, what will happen to you as an individual? Is not dependent on any single man. And if need be, the baton will be passed to others. But as always, individually, just as with the Worldwide Church of God, we must decide what we'll do if and when the baton is passed. Individually, we must decide whether to take the baton, whether to hold onto it tightly, Sometimes people are running and they drop the baton. Or they will stay in the race all the way to the end. But specifically, the question is, how to be among those who endure to the end? And I guess that is something that we'll have to wait for another sermon.